You let one ant stand up to us, then they all might stand up. Those puny little ants outnumber us 100 to 1. And if they ever figure that out, there goes our way of life. It's not about food. It's about keeping those ants in line. That's why we're going back.
Does anybody else want to stay?
Let's ride!
It's gonna happen soon. It's gonna happen soon. Man, I have been itching to get back on since Friday night. Saturday and Sunday, they just really destroy me. I've got to empty the tank somehow, and it's just, I don't know what it is. And then, of course, we had such a crazy weekend here. We got so much to do tonight, which is why we're starting about 7 minutes early. But welcome, everybody. I hope you're all chilling. It's about 7 to 7 on Monday evening. We got great, great guests coming on tonight. Across the room from me right now, Mr. Tim Poole. Tim, how are you, man?
Good.
There he is, just hanging out. We're going to have him on the air for the entirety of the show. Tim is an independent journalist that we've actually been following for a very long time. Really started making a name for himself right with Occupy Wall Street.
Yep.
You know, and we appreciated it so much because we've been streaming, we've been doing webcasts since 2006, and to see live streaming being used in such an innovative way to actually bring real, unbiased, in-your-face, this is what's going on, journalism, without any spin and really just kind of interactive and, you know, cozy in very many ways, that was something that was very, very interesting to see happen. So Tim's going to be on with us. Tim, you just jump in whenever the hell you'd like. We know that you were down there for at the time that the explosions happened in the city. Well, one explosion. Another one didn't go off. And then, of course, we had the Seaside pipe bomb that was ill-timed. Thank God. But our first guest of the evening is actually going to be Maj Touré of Black Guns Matter. And he'll be on at about 7:10. And you know, I was watching more of the of CNN's The 60s on Netflix over the weekend. Tim, you ever see that?
Nope.
No. Get that that microphone a little bit closer to your right on top of it too.
How's that?
Oh, there you go. A lot
now
better.
I can hear myself.
Yeah, speak until you hear yourself. That's the best thing to do. But the one thing I was looking at there, especially when you look at all of the social upheaval and the societal change and everything that's going on the streets, there's a big cultural movements going on in this country especially in those two decades of the 60s and the 70s. But for the most part, I feel like, and you tell me what you think, and Gypsy, you're on too, so you can say whatever you like. I see you over there. For the most part, whereas there was a lot of change on the streets and this big time cultural movement, you got the hippies, you got San Francisco flower power, all that's the protesting of the Vietnam War, as much as there was things, it's of course the Civil Rights Act, all those movements that were going on, as much as what was going on, I feel like from what I've been seeing and taking in, that people did not lose their faith. And whether that meant faith on a religious level or just a little bit more of a widespread spirituality, I feel like there was something there always anchoring people, well, at least the majority of people. There's always that fringe that just you can't reach them. Only thing is that I think the fringe is the majority now. And, you know, I look at this. It seemed like God, the concept of God or any other spirit, has nothing to do with things that are going on today, and it's a type of cultural environment I would draw up in a movie script as a preamble to the birth of the Antichrist. Like, you know, I look at what's going on right now, and I'm thinking of, like, the opening sequences of Arnold Schwarzenegger's End of Days.
It reminds me of that that quote where people say it's almost like the United States was built on Indian burial grounds.
Yeah.
I mean, this shit is it's spiraling crazily out of control. I mean, did you guys see that story where in Florida there's a sinkhole that's been sinking in toxic waste for, like, the past, like, 3 weeks, millions of gallons?
Yes.
You know, I don't, you know, listen.
Are you talking about the gas leak? I know there's a gasoline leak somewhere.
No, there's a sinkhole that's soaking up, like, toxic waste, and it's getting into the groundwater.
Okay.
But a few years ago, and this might still be going on in Louisiana, a sinkhole, a salt dome underground collapsed due to mining efforts, and it started just swallowing everything, and there are these videos of trees just being sucked into the ground. All the water is just, it's getting bigger and bigger.
You know, sinkholes always made me very uneasy.
Oh, yeah. Quicksand in movies?
It just...
Princess Bride?
But more so sinkholes, because it's just like this bottomless pit just appears out of nowhere, and it just starts growing. I feel like it's just like the earth has, like, it's been, I don't know, it's like a fungus or something wrong. I hate topical diseases.
I'm with you.
I hate topical diseases.
Not to go too far. Like, you know, on websites, on all the way in the bottom, there are those weird stories, and then they have, like, they'll show that person's knee, and it has those weird little dots on it.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Ugh, I can't stand that.
Trying to get you to...
That's what...
You know...
Sorry.
Go ahead.
In following the through line of the end of the world and the Antichrist and collapsing ground, fracking, right?
Mm.
You know, so there are these satellite pictures, which many people probably have already seen. It's a nighttime photo of America, and the frack fields in North Dakota are as bright as New York City.
Wow.
And that's just fracking. You know, now we know the earthquakes are being caused by this. We know it's polluting groundwater. People are lighting their taps on fire for years.
You know, that's one of the things that I really... I consider myself a constitutionalist. I consider myself conservative. But not in any kind of slap a party sticker on me type of way. And there's points of departure for me that always... come up, and fracking is one of those things that come up for me. I watched, you know, all the HBO Gasland documentaries. Another thing, a point of departure for me is marijuana. I am appreciator. I'm an appreciator of marijuana, and I'm a believer in it in every sense, not just recreational. But, you know, that's just one of those things where, you know, you hardline Republicans, it's about fracking and this and that. And me, on the other hand, I'm like, I don't know, man. Things don't look right. It can't be just spin that things are going wrong. I don't know. That's just one of those things. Fracking is one of those things I can't really even comment on because I see so many colliding opinions.
This is why a two-party system will never last forever. You know, because you can't... there's the meme where it says, I believe women have a choice, but I should also be allowed to own a gun. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Right now, in the United States, you can either choose one extreme or the other, and you don't agree with either of them. It's just people just pick one issue that's more important to them. So then what happens when you're like, well, I'm a constitutionalist. I believe people have a right to smoke weed or do other recreational drugs, but I don't want to let companies just rip apart the earth and destroy, you know, which party do you pick then? Because the mainstream parties won't service any of that.
Oh, totally. Totally. You have to be able to just take things one at a time, debate them. And that's another reason why we can get into this on another show. It's another reason why I can't stand the notion of continuing resolutions in Congress and how you just lump all the spending into one bill. It was never supposed to be like that. It's a way that government, that parties hold another party hostage for political reasons. Mm-hmm. We're going to let the government shut down if you don't approve all this because you don't want to fund this one particular part of the entire resolution. It shouldn't be like that, just because it lets... I mean, what you have the government holding one state or one place hostage for their highway funds because they didn't want to fund Planned Parenthood or this and that. Take it one thing at a time, and that's another... It's just another tool of that partisanship that destroys everything. It's
You know what I think about when I hear stuff like this? Like, when the government was first... I thought about how the United States government was set up. You know, three branches, checks and balances, and it seems really brilliant. You know, it's not an executive monarchy. It's not, you know, an anarchic council. It's kind of a little bit of everything that keeps each other in check. But then just over time, it gets corrupted. It just rots, you know?
Mm.
And we're at this point now where nobody cares anymore. You know, like, congressmen for sale, whatever. Politicians for sale, take corporate, you know, and now with the DNC leaks,
oh,
we're seeing just nobody cares.
Sold off every ambassadorship there is to be sold. It looks like even Jay Johnson bought his own secretaryship.
And yet they're more concerned with Donald Trump eating fried chicken with a fork and a knife. That's what people want. That's apparently what the news is getting the ratings on. Meanwhile, leaks come out. Your government is for sale, and everyone's like, yeah, we know that already. We don't care anymore. That's like the attitude.
And this is the problem I have on a nightly basis, because everyone's like, the Constitution is just not doesn't work. I said, wait a second. Wait, the Constitution is not relevant. It has been circumvented. It's not that it doesn't work. And then, so I'm more of a, it's not so much a conservative. It's more like a preservative. How do we get back to grain one, where you actually really do allow communities to take care of themselves, states to take care of themselves, without having this oligarchy hanging over our heads?
I think, was the quote from Thomas Jefferson, purging the government every 200 years of some sort?
Mm-hmm.
I think, the principles of the Constitution, for the most part, how we amend it and we make it better over time and things we agree with, we kind of need to shake out all the dirt, and get it up to date. There's a lot of things that...
What would you get up to date? I get very scared when people say up to date.
I'm thinking about how technology is changing our society and how we're trying to figure out a society how to address, when it comes to the gun debate, right? This is an easier one. Oh, well, the Founding Fathers never expected you to have a, 15-round semi-automatic walk in and blah, 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 blah. But does that matter, right? So we need to sort of come, how do I say this? It's like... Yeah, we need to look at the principles that we hold to be true, right?
Mm-hmm.
Free speech, all these things that are in the Constitution, and assert protections that are relevant today based on technology. Okay, so I guess a better example is the internet. Is when the FBI hacks your computer, is that a warrantless search, right?
Yes.
So they're claiming it's not. Now the judge is saying it is. And because it's not, now we're having an argument amongst themselves whether or not certain things that are happening with new technology that didn't exist before applies to what they wrote about back then.
Mm.
So it's kind of like we need to update the language and, in my opinion, make some of it broader, right?
Yeah, totally. I would have to. I definitely agree with you that on the Fourth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment has been absolutely destroyed. The Second Amendment is a little bit deeper for me. I don't think that... I think that what we're seeing here with gun control, and our first guest is going to be a gun control guest, is we have been... trapped in the jaws of a really destructive progressive movement. And it's the same people who really is the same party, the same type of thinking that ran out gun control as a concept in the first place to make sure that slaves were not able to arm themselves. Same kind of debate. The first instances of government getting involved with marriage licenses was to make sure there was no interracial marriages. It's not a function of government. You want to talk about shaking out the dirt from the Constitution. What is the real function of federal government? They are so minute. Everything is really just, okay, Maine, New York, you guys talk amongst yourselves. Somebody in Bangor, a senator from Bangor, should not be able to tell what somebody in Rhode Island does. You know what your communities are. You know what you guys need. If New York wants to socialize medicine, if they want to do something, whatever, they should be able to do it.
And then you have, the DEA raids in California's dispensaries.
Mm.
When the state said this is legal and you're allowed to do it, you get the threats from the federal government when Colorado and Washington make recreational marijuana legal. So it's kind of like... we as a people can decide amongst our communities, our personal communities, hey, we should be allowed to do this and it shouldn't be illegal. And the federal government, who's not even a part of our community, right,
mm-hmm.
comes in and decides it should be different.
I love it. It as if somebody in D.C. would be able to tell you how things in Williamsburg, Brooklyn should be. It's like, wait a second, you don't live here. You don't know what the hell we need. We've got city councilmen and women. We've got our mayor. We've got our system over here. If we need something, if we got to change something. And that, I think that's the real big thing. Now, I'm a lot more, as of late, and it's going to get worse with me, I know it, I've been a lot more conspiratorial. I think that there's something much bigger at work here. Nothing feels right. It just doesn't feel right. And the perception of what's going on in the news right now scares me the most, because it really takes something. For me, I think especially with the problems we have with policing, yes, there is police brutality. There has always been police brutality. But I feel like tensions rise in towns where there was never a problem because of the way that it's being reported on the news. You have a town that's having a problem somewhere in some part of the world, and then the news makes somebody on another side of the country completely busybodied, amped up to the way that they start diagnosing problems where there was none. I think that there's a lot of big time problems here with that.
I've been having this conversation for the past month or so since, you know, because I was independent journalist for a few years. I worked for Vice and helped start Vice News and all that. And so I've worked for big companies, and now that I'm back on my own, I can't get out of my head. These problems you're talking about are a symptom of the, you know, we've got so much media that everyone's trying to figure out how do we, you know. I think the Daily Mail makes something like 10,000 articles per day or some ridiculous number. How much news is actually going to happen, right? One or two stories. There's a bombing in New York. They caught the guy. That's news.
Right.
So what are they trying to do in between? They just, I don't know, let's just make something crazy and try and get traffic. And so, you know, I've seen startup news sites that I've really respected. They come out with a mission. You know, we're going to do real news. It's going to be totally legitimate. 2 months go by and it becomes a super left-wing feminist blog or... You know, it turns into an ultra right wing, you know, Trump supporting. They just ultimately decide that, you know what, we can't get people to read honest truth. Let's just swing it as hard as we can in the craziest direction and light it on fire.
Let's pick a niche, clickbait. Yep. They just, everything. The clickbaiting is, but people are starting to reject this shit too, though.
Yeah. Yeah. That's,
I think that's the best part here. Now our guest at the 7:10 mark, which is in 2 minutes, but he hasn't accepted the Skype request yet. So I want to give him a little bit of a bio. Maj Touré is a founder of Black Guns Matter. And this is a clip right here. You know what? We have 2 minutes till we get him on. Let's watch this one video of him. This is 2 minutes, 48 seconds. This is from the Rebel Pundit channel on YouTube. Let's check that out.
Few people at the top trying to de-arm, you know, urban communities. That's what it is.
What do you think about the push against guns and gun ownership in society right now, especially how it relates to the issues in black communities?
It ain't society. It's a few people at the top trying to de-arm, you know, urban communities. That's what it is. The general, see them young people, they rocking them t-shirts that we gave them because they understand the importance of a firearm being essential to American culture. You know, the founding fathers, you know, spit that however many hundred years ago. Their thing was, look, we resisting tyranny. You know what I mean? Whatever happened in England, we don't really rock with y'all no more. We ain't liking y'all. It's taxation without representation, we out. And we're gonna throw these hollows at you if you don't respect what we're doing over here in this new country.
Does gun ownership make the community safer, do you feel?
No, I don't feel, I know. I mean, there's statistics. One came out, the University of Pittsburgh did one, I tweeted it today. However many years study to show that most violent crime is not committed by car-carrying good guys and car-carrying good girls, firearm owners. People are we're very technical people, because if you do this wrong, you might get your hand or head blown off, you know? So we're very technical, pay attention to detail, by the book people, and we respect the law, you know what I mean? Again, that's part of American culture. So places like Texas, you take Texas for example, there's a culture there that you know that those people respect their firearms. And you as the bad guy or the bad girl, you're not running in a house or unless you want to run into some buckshot. You know, and you know that. So the crime is a deterrent. Firearms are a deterrent.
How do you feel about the Democrat Party's position on guns? Hillary and Bernie themselves.
I think anybody has the right to be as foolish as they want to be. And it's just contradictory to me that these people say no guns, guns are bad, more gun control, while at the same time their security detail is walking around with M5s. If you want to put your money where your mouth is, give your security detail mace. I mean, that's what I would do if I don't believe in firearms, or I think there should be more. But the point there is, they have their security detail has the right. They're trained, they're responsible guys, just like every other citizen that takes it upon themselves to be trained, to be responsible, to be exercising their Second Amendment rights. So I think it's very contradictory for them to say that and not put their money where their mouth is.
And I'm going to try to give Maj a call right now, although I don't know if it's going to happen. It might. It just might. 7:12. We're making decent time. It is decent time. Everybody's got their fingers crossed. This Skype game. All right, well, while that's ringing, we're going to move on to something. Let's see what's going on in the chat room. Gadget Doc, what's going on? Moonlit Altar, Nikki, and now that has to be Johnny Vroom, Frankie Castle, Jenny Lee, Murr. What's going on, everybody? We've got Tim Poole in the house. Also, we have Gypsy hanging out. Matt is on the couch chilling out. Lauren is on the couch as well. Going to try calling Maj again in a little bit. It's not answering right now. But let's get back to something else. Now, there's a few other things here. First of all, where did the... there you go. Now, there's a few other things here. Now, getting back to what's going on in New York. So what else we have to talk about tonight? We're going to have Alex Plitzis on. If it gets to the point where Maj does not come on tonight, I'll definitely get him on either tomorrow or something else. We've been in contact frequently over the last couple days setting this up. So, but what else we have going on tonight? We're going to talk about Manhattan and Seaside bombings, the stabbings in Minnesota. We have Alex Plitzis coming on with us at the bottom of the hour. Of course, today we learned that Ahmad Khan Rahami, of course, a Buddhist nationalist, a Buddhist Irish nationalist, suspected for both Manhattan and Seaside bombings, where I was apprehended today. But we have what's going on now. Did you know, Tim, that this Ahmad Khan Rahami guy, he had actually sued the police at one point for monitoring him?
Wow.
That's what's coming out here today. And it's another thing that's really, really getting me crazy. I'm telling you, it's subtle, but you have people who have these intentions that know how to throw people off the scent now. I believe that the political correctness is getting so bad in this country that even if you have ill intentions, because we are the priority one is not being offensive, that people who are the most undesirable in the world have ways of throwing you off and throwing your own ridiculousness in your face.
Don't get me started on political correctness, man.
What's plagued you over the last
I was in an Uber the other day, and it was an Uber pool, so I got a driver, and I got this old guy next to me, and we segued into politics, and everyone's arguing, who's worse, Trump or Hillary? Because, you know, everyone's like, oh, I don't know, it's hard to figure out, right? And at the end of it, we're like, you know what? To hell with all the politicians, right? So I tweeted, you know, I regularly find myself getting into friendly arguments. You know, we're friendly about it, where we try and figure out who's the worst, who's the more evil, for what reason. Mm. But at the end, we're just like, to hell with everyone. And this guy, this rich white guy, starts immediately, tweets at me like 50 times about how I'm racist, my friends are racist, we're white privileged racists. Anybody who supports Trump or anyone who downplays Hillary is a sexist, racist, white privilege. And he's just tweeting at me like crazy. And I'm like, what the hell are you talking about? Sick. So I tweet back to him. I'm like, I'm just saying, like, we're kind of like to hell with politicians. And he goes, anybody who would say to hell with politicians in this race is a racist, sexist.
I'm like, and he wasn't trolling you.
No,
he
was... no. This is like he's like a TV show producer in LA. And he's a rich white guy. And I'm like, dude, I'm a mixed-race high school dropout from the south side of Chicago, right? And I'm trying to be chill about, like, politics and identity politics. And I'm like, how are you a rich white guy lecturing the mixed-race guy about white privilege?
This is the sickness of white liberals.
I'm so confused. I'm like, I'm not saying he's, you know, look, I understand, you know, the arguments, the perspectives, and I respect everyone for their, you know, for their beliefs. I'd love to hear more about what they have to say. But not when you just go off the rails and start screaming, you know, that everything is racist all the time.
There are people who are just sitting there waiting for it, to be honest. I mean, everybody's waiting. I mean, seriously, you talk about murder of crows. Everybody's just looking around waiting for something to just swoop down on. And it's the reason why I really just stay away from Facebook. Okay, I tend to our groups and our fan pages, and holy shit, I really have been good with this. I only really post when there's a new update on Star Wars Battlefront. That's just it.
Did you hear about the Black Lives Matter protesters in London who are protesting climate change?
Yes.
Saying that yes. climate change is racist?
He said climate change is racist because most of the countries that are affected are like sub-Saharan African countries, and that climate change... And this thing that kills me, because when we whether it's climate change or whether it's Bill de Blasio rolling back public urination and public decency laws because they said it was racist... People need to also be taught. We don't have nuance anymore. We have a bunch of wind-up toys out there who are just cranked and set into one direction to just walk off and do all the damage you can. The nuance that is lost to people that I find more often than anything is being able to decipher whether or not something in itself is racist or if something has racial impacts. You know, I mean, it's unbelievable to me to say climate change, something that is in, you can't touch it, is racist in itself. But no, if you are you going to make a scientific claim that the rising temperatures, if it is true or whatever the hell, wherever you're coming from, your claim is rising temperatures has an impact on this part of the area, this part of the world more than others? Okay. You can't tell me that your theory, the theory that you're painting, is racist. I mean, you created this.
You know, I've been meaning to make, you know, a video about, like, my perspective on racism and this, like, left-right fight. And, you know, the thing is for me, my mom's Korean. I'm a quarter Korean. I'm not half. But I grew up with a mom who is visibly not white. You know, you wouldn't assume she was half at all. She actually looks like she's Hispanic. And we had bricks thrown through our window. We had our house vandalized by people, like, putting, you know, white supremacy pamphlets in our house. This was when I was a little kid in Chicago. The things that my family went through, my grandmother is a full 100% Korean from Seoul, and my grandfather is German-Irish. They met in World War II, and it was illegal for them to be together. And they had to keep fleeing different places because they were being, you know, persecuted. And then a similar thing happens to my dad and my mom. And this is how I'm raised, right? And then all of a sudden, you know, the mixed race family, I'm getting lectured by white people about how white people are bad and how I have white privilege and I'm bad. And I'm absolutely confused because I grew up without, you know, where I grew up in the south side of Chicago, I had people call me gook. I had, you know, like I said, my house was vandalized. And then when I get older, I'm like, you know what, finally maybe this old school racism will go away.
Mm.
And it flips back on me to where they're like, well, because you're part white, you're bad too. So now it's like I get shit on no matter what happens.
And that's just the craziest thing about it. Now, I can give two shits about what somebody tells me about white privilege. I just don't care. It's something I turn off when I hear stupidity. And I don't understand that stance that's been taken, especially by white people, the white guilt, the self-flagellation. I don't know where it's come. Well, I do know where it's come from. This is what cultural Marxism does. It has been a very slow burn. It has destroyed any kind of semblance of decency, any kind of real equality. There's always been, we have this kind of shift, this pendulum swing, instead of trying to actually go forward together in equal opportunity, we have people that are bending over backwards to make equal results for others, even if it means that they have to defame themselves. And it's so sick because it doesn't help anybody. Because even if they did achieve equality, they've still rendered themselves a completely useless slug. Like, they're just so pitiful. The white liberals have made themselves so pitiful. Willingly, and it's supposed to be a sign of humility, but it all comes back to that paternalism that I can't stand. I don't know how. I think that a lot of them do it because they want to have, you know, black and Hispanic friends, and they have hard time socializing. I don't think that it would. I don't think that it would make them friends acting like this.
I think it's more about. It's it comes in waves, right? You know, we had political correctness comes in and out of popular culture. At South Park made the joke. They said, oh, political correctness is back. And it'll go away eventually. It's like, you know, every decade there's this wave that happens.
Mm.
You know, but what gets me is when people talk about white privilege and all that stuff is what they really need to be saying is it's majority privilege. You know, it's nothing. I believe it's class and majority. Because mm-hmm. when you look at countries like China, when you look at countries in Africa, that's not white privilege there, you know, because, you know, countries like China are particularly racist against white people, against anyone who's not Chinese, you know? And so then you come to the United States and people are like, oh, but white people are the problem. And it's like, no. There's a political, something political happens when a culture is based on one particular, like, I don't want to say race, but class or race or belief system.
Right.
It could be religion and you'd have Catholic privilege. You know what I mean? So.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, no, it's just people say, you know what? It's white people that are the problem. And the way they believe, and I'm like, look, if our country was majority one other race, it wouldn't be about white people.
So. But that's the thing now. You know, you see like in the president's final South Asian tour, thank God for it, because he was completely, you know, nobody respects him around the world. He was dissed in every country he landed in. China, they didn't even roll out the red carpet for him anymore. Like, nobody can stand the guy. And you know what? When he's out there, you're talking about, and this has been coming up a lot lately, not just with President Obama, but everybody loves dropping, almost like, and it's celebratory. I don't care. People say, oh, he didn't say that. No. Once again, nuance. Think about what's being said here. There's something very celebratory in these announcements that by 2050, the United States is not going to be a majority white country, which who the fuck cares? Why is that even a thing? As long as we're all bound by individual liberty, free market, being able to do what you want to do, we have protections under the law. That are based in philosophy, natural law. I'm not even talking about common law. The Constitution is based in natural law, not a good idea that the founders had. Free speech, free association, the right to protect yourself and your property and your family and your country. Those are natural law right there of just existing. And for anybody to use identity politics and talk about racial majorities and minorities and how it's going to shift here and maybe things will get and just try to just to usher that kind of suggestion out there is just so sick to me, because it really just shows you that even at the top levels of our government right now, we are not talking about content of character. We're talking specifically on color. It's really sickening to me.
You know what I think it really comes down to? I think it's the media. News organizations try to figure out what kind of traffic, what kind of content will get the most shares, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so they you know, so years ago, with the Facebook algorithms being the way they are, people started to notice that police brutality videos got shared a lot, right? And I think the reason for it was people demand justice and are appalled when they see these police brutality videos. So everyone shares it. And then people look at the theme of that video and say, let's do more of that because it got us traffic. We can make money off this. Eventually, you end up with a media that's chasing after one theme, and then you're inundating with the public with this thing you're saying is true, you know? Mm. And so then everyone immediately believes this is the paramount, most important, most devastating, dangerous thing. And it's kind of like terrorism was right after 9/11. Everyone was like, it's the most dangerous thing ever, when in reality, you know, more people die from eating peanuts than terror. But yet we spend like 200 times more money on anti-terror.
Right.
It's the media says, you know what, this will get us ratings, this will get us traffic, let's flood, do more and more.
If it bleeds, it leads.
Exactly. And then everyone starts living their life believing this is the most important thing that's happening. And you know, people need a bad guy. You know, people want to live their life thinking that they're fighting against the machine, and the machine changes shape, the man changes shape, you know?
Yeah.
And nowadays, with like feminism, it's quite literally the man.
Totally. Yeah. Totally. We have to get that evil patriarchy. Now, I have Alex Plitzis that's going to be on with us. Now, let me just quickly do a little bit of something before Alex gets on. Now, I was thinking about this as when we were talking about the bombing in New York City. Right off the bat, we're saying this was an individual act. We heard this coming out. We're all right. And now, when I hear this, serial killers act as individuals. But if, say, David Berkowitz, and he confessed to all of his murders, he claimed to have been obeying the orders of a demon that manifested in the form of that dog named Harvey, who belonged to a man named Sam next door. Well, what if we started noticing that a bunch of serial killers are all worshiping the same Harvey the dog? What happens when you have zealots drawing from the same source of inspiration? That's what I want to know. Granted, it takes the individual to stab someone or set up a bomb, but the inspiration is shared on a network, you know, network on a global scale. I'm talking about radical Islam. And the thing that gets me is, and you even heard Josh Earnest come out and say, we are fighting a narrative war. Once again, my biggest criticism of all this stuff is it is not that discriminatory a thing if we are inclusive on this and we don't take the political correct stance to try to sit here and debate vernacular instead of debating what is really a problem and what is a threat and where do we see trends forming in. And you have people saying, but, the vast majority of the whole who worship, you know, Harvey the dog aren't violent. And that may be true. But a religion is almost like granting internet access to a network of computers, okay? Some users will find art, they'll find history, they'll seek a greater understanding of the universe and life in general. You know, others will find snuff films and Tumblr. That's just what's going to happen. You have this thing that happens, and you can't really judge the peaceful elements of a religion for acts of the insane, but you can clearly and responsibly make the observation on which religions or networks are more prone to violence than others. And we won't even talk about how, you know, the knife and the IED narratives would be completely different had it been a gun, because as we saw in Nice, France, it was referred to as a truck attack. But also remember that after Orlando, the missives were circulated instructing people to start attacking mainly white targets, because if they didn't do so, progressive American government was going to take the blame for it, accusing the Second Amendment or crafting hate crime narratives. So it's all as sick as it is to watch us dance around the issue once again, and it's even more sick to see how you can bet money on what direction the narrative is going to go in, depending on what chips are on the table still. And something is just so terribly wrong with this. Now, today, Alex Plitzis put out another great article with the IJ Review, and I want to get his thoughts on some stuff here, because something is terribly wrong and dirty.
Hello?
Alex Plitzis, how are you, my friend?
Frank, good. Good to hear your voice. What's going on?
Well, listen, we're just hanging out here. We did your bios, your backgrounds. Everybody knows your great set of skills, okay? You are living Liam Neeson. You are Taken. That is just you, okay? So now what we need to know from you is, now I haven't gone through your article yet on air just because we haven't had the time. One thing led to another.
Sure.
But from a counterterrorism standpoint, what are your thoughts on all the information that's been made public with Manhattan and Seaside? Oh, Minnesota.
Go ahead.
And Minnesota.
I think we're exceptionally lucky. I think this could have been very, very bad and much more serious. If you read some of the news that's come out, we were actually pretty fortunate that a couple of either homeless guys or thieves, depending on the article that you read, actually stumbled upon some of the devices in Manhattan, tried to steal the bags, and in doing so, opened them up and saw the bombs inside, discarded them, inadvertently disabling the bombs.
Jesus.
So if you can imagine that, only in New York would that happen.
I didn't know that at all.
That's how they got their information, from the cell phone. From the cell phones
themselves. Yeah, cell phones, and there was a fingerprint left on one of the devices that was rendered useless by either the homeless guy or the thief that was trying to steal the bag on the side of the road. So
hey, maybe
New York pickpockets turned into counterterrorism professionals by accident.
I was going to say, maybe we should train the homeless in how to defuse bombs. I mean, they know the streets better than anybody.
They have in New Jersey, too.
Well, if nothing else, at least recognizing what doesn't make sense to be able to point it out.
So, Tim, you said that happened in Jersey, too?
In Jersey, a couple thieves found the bag, and they stole it. When they opened it up and saw there was bombs in it, they called the police.
Oh, Jesus.
So twice,
yeah.
The New York, you know, New Jersey area was rescued by the scumbags of, the, you know.
Isn't it amazing, Alex, how, you know, look at this. You can have the most expansive surveillance and police state out there. But once you just release the public to do their thing, they always find everything that you were looking for. We saw this during the Boston Marathon bombing, too. They shut an entire metropolis down. They couldn't find a 17-year-old. And then all of a sudden, they lifted the curfew, and a man finds him in his backyard hiding in his boat. It's just it's unbelievable to see what happens when the citizenry are just let loose.
Well, I have to ask you, did you ask yourself the right question? You said in their first opening part of that statement, you know, given the great surveillance state that we live in, my question for you is, in light of this, how great is it?
Not good at all. Now, why
do you... So I think people oftentimes misunderstand just how much... I mean, you can't watch every single person all the time. And even if you've got cameras everywhere, they're only as good as your ability to monitor them.
So
unless you've got 8 million cops watching cameras, yeah, they may be recording information and people worried about civil liberties, but are people actively watching? Clearly not.
Well, let me ask you this. Is that a segue into a conversation about profiling? Is profiling necessary?
People engage in profiling every day. And I think it is necessary, but not to the extent that people are sort of saying. I mean, if you think about it, how many times, you know, be honest about this, you're in a neighborhood that's predominantly one ethnicity or another, one racial group or another. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. You're from one of the opposite groups and you're driving either an expensive or inexpensive car. Are the cops going to pull you over? Are they doing that because you have done anything wrong? But because by profile, you don't belong where you are. By these cops patrolling these neighborhoods and knowing on a regular basis who lives there and who doesn't, if you're in an impoverished neighborhood and all of a sudden you're showing up with, you know, a Mercedes truck at 3 o'clock in the morning, they might profile you and saying, like, you don't belong here. What are you looking for? Or vice versa. Not saying that it's right by any means, but it happens on a daily basis. And when they're wrong, people fall victim to stereotyping and being stopped because they don't appear, quote unquote, to belong where they are, at least according to people who are stopping them. Mm-hmm. But when they're right, the cops get praised, you know, and that's kind of just hit or miss. I mean, look at all the comments about the militarization of police after what took place out in Ferguson with the protests in Missouri. Look at the armed police response today in New Jersey, right? Suburban New Jersey. This is not downtown New York City. And they showed up, you know, heavy weapons, armor, everything else, not a peep out of the media. So that's where it's kind of the double standard for the cops. It's like, you know, damned if they do, damned if they don't.
We were just talking about that. Tim, we were just talking about that media perception. What did you really want to hone in on? This is one of those things that is not really a source of outrage that needs to be tapped into on a media sense. You know, sometimes it just happens and nobody really says anything about it. But it's not really one of those things that is a priority. Now, let me ask you something. I'm having a harder time to consider anything other than a nefarious plot, okay? And I was just telling Tim, Tim Poole is with us as well as Gypsy, and we have a nice viewing audience at home. I am becoming more and more conspiratorial. You know this about me, and I'm thinking about...
You do like to entertain.
I'm thinking about this power-grabbing shadow government, and because basically, you know, seriously, the difference in opinion on whether or not the public should fund certain things in government, whether it be Planned Parenthood or something else, that's okay. We can debate stuff like that. But on matters of life and death, on matters of, you know, I feel like to say we're on different pages is an understatement. Like, for example, why is this progressive movement clutching to Islam in such a maternal way? Why do we have Josh Earnest coming out there talking about how we're fighting a narrative war instead of we're fighting a real ideological war that we need to just get honest with each other about, work together on with, and not make this into such a political mess? What the hell is going on?
So I think it's rather funny. I mean that in the saddest sense. So you have the White House spokesman on television today talking about this being a bankrupt ideology, and him referring to Daesh, as the rest of us will call them, the rest of the world has asked the United States and our federal government to call them. It's basically a nasty term for what the Islamic State calls themselves. And he calls them ISIL, which is the acronym for the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. The first two letters of that acronym stand for the Islamic State. By using that term, he legitimizes them in the same statement as he's saying that they're not legitimate. this entire narrative has been ridiculous, and that we have not had a real ideological discussion really since this really kicked off. I mean, at the end of the day, we have a military fight against a well-armed force in Iraq and Syria, having acquired a good amount of military hardware. It's the first time I've seen like a real terrorist army in that perspective, in that regard. And we have a counterterrorism strategy that we're having to execute because, as you can see, there's lone wolves that are radicalized, and there are directed plots against the homeland that are rising from the Middle East that's under control of this group. But at the heart of all of this is an ideological battle. Just like the Cold War, you know, we never really engaged in battle with Russian troops. But this is something that transcended partisan politics over presidential cycles over the course of a generation that took us to defeat that ideology and really win. We haven't even begun to take it on. And, you know, it's radical Islam. It's not mainstream. It's not accepted by mainstream Muslims. It's not accepted by mainstream thought or scholars or anything else. It's a bastardization of what really is a peaceful religion. Well, some people laugh at that. It actually is true.
But to deny that,
the administration's failure to even discuss it or even use the term is ridiculous. How are you ever going to defeat an ideology that you won't even discuss or use or call it by its name? I mean, it's absurd.
Now, let me ask you this. This is something that, you know, I had this one piece of information here that I read today. I took it down as soon as I saw it. Between 2001 and 2013, the U.S. permanently resettled 1.5 million Muslim migrants on green cards. However, under Hillary Clinton's stated proposals, Muslim immigration would grow substantially faster, adding nearly 1 million Muslim migrants to the U.S. during her first term alone. I say to myself, well, there you have it. You know, illegal immigration and Muslim refugees, they get their voting rights eventually, and then you get to ask, who's your daddy? Of course, the Democrats are. But with what's going on here, and we've seen CIA, FBI, all types of Homeland Security heads come out and say that this is a guarantee, not a maybe. These refugee populations will be infiltrated by terrorists. Now, by that being a guarantee, what the hell is really being ushered in? This is where my conspiracy side comes out. I really do believe that when you are bringing in groups of people, and you're guaranteed that some of them are going to attempt to kill or kill Americans, then I really do believe that you are importing some sort of a culture clash on purpose to create chaos and to legitimize the building of centralized power in some kind of way, like we're seeing in Europe right now with this migrant crisis that has already been confirmed funded by George Soros. So, I mean, this is where I'm just going to right now, because I don't understand how anybody, under the guise of humanitarianism, would be able to go in front of a television camera and tell the American people, it is our duty to risk our lives, even if it's just a couple hundred people a year that will die because of dumpster bombs. I do not see how any American politician has the right to put anybody's life who is not going to be as well protected as them at stake.
So I think they're going to talk about this in terms of us being an immigrant country and putting blanket bans on groups of people, first of all, that you couldn't even have a religious test for. You know, like Trump's initial proposal was, you know, ban all Muslims. Like, what are you going to do? They get to the airport, you ask them if you're Muslim, and they say no, then what the hell are you going to say back? There's no real way of knowing. It's one thing when you talk about nationality coming from countries that are troubled, but even in that sense, you know, it's really, this is one of the valid questions that have been asked, especially in light of this gentleman, whoever else knows who's coming in. How good is our vetting process? I mean, he's naturalized, traveled multiple times to Pakistan, Afghanistan, to Kandahar, and then to Quetta. These are not vacation hotspots. You know, these are not places you want to be going to. So it's clear that there is a vetting problem somewhere in our security apparatus because this was allowed to make its way through. And in terms of why they'd be pushing for something like this, you know, conspiracy-wise, in terms of creating a new voter base, fine. I mean, you can have the argument there.
I think that's secondary to the chaos. I think it's secondary to the chaos that's being caused. Look at what's going on in Europe right now. You have European male population that's been completely deballed, in my opinion, because they don't want to fight against what the hell's really going on. You have tons of sexual assaults that are instances that have increased by thousands of percentage points. You have
Yeah.
You have increased terrorist activity all over the continent, and you have people who are afraid to say anything because at heart they're not racist, but at the other hand, they're watching everything they knew to be reality be washed away because of a conflict that has created a refugee crisis that they themselves also did not have a hand in. That's the thing that really gets me
sour. But we did, Frank. But we did. And I think the answer to your question is simple. I think you hit it. And that is, what is easier for an administration that has failed to take any meaningful action in Syria right now? To either accept refugees in this country and allow the Republican Party to paint themselves as racists and xenophobes because they don't want a large immigrant population coming in that they think may be potentially tainted with, you know, terrorists who they've mixed themselves in, or take some sort of meaningful military action with long-term commitment in Iraq and Syria to stabilize the area so the refugee crisis stops and people stop coming, which is going to cost billions of dollars, if not trillions, and you know how many thousands of American lives. I think the political calculus for the Democrats, especially those in charge right now, is very clear.
Do you think that
very easy in their minds?
If there was ever somebody that would commit to an operation that would bring stabilization to the region, do you think there would be any kind of significant repatriation program or anything? What happens when Syria and...
It's not even possible at this point.
Quite impossible. So do you think that Europe just has to live with what they have now forever?
That's absolutely the case. I mean, because even... So there's two things that would have to happen. One, you'd have to build a coalition... Probably, I mean, the only way we would do it is have to be like Saudi and Turkish troops on the ground inside of Syria and allow them to form the government afterwards, giving our air cover, because there's no way in hell anybody would send American troops in. But even after doing that, and then once you were to take out ISIS and then, you know, potentially Assad in the mix, because it's the only way it's going to happen unless you agree to leave Assad in power. And I don't want to go down that road. We've discussed that a bunch. But whatever decision that you make, once you stabilize the country, only then can you rebuild. You begin the nation building process. The infrastructure has literally been completely destroyed in half the country. It's unlivable. The buildings are gone. There's no public utilities. There's nothing for people to return to. So you gotta get in there. You gotta stabilize it. You gotta rebuild. And only at that point could these people talk about going back to their home country.
Got
it. So I mean, it's not even an option right now. You can't send them back to a bombed-out shithole. There's nothing to send them back to.
It's really, really fucked.
Yeah, we are looking. I mean, we're talking about the refugee crisis and the secondary and tertiary effects of that being, you know, potential terrorist acts in the United States and Europe. That in itself is a secondary effect of our failure to have any meaningful policy being executed in Iraq and Syria right now. The refugee crisis continues. The infrastructure continues to be destroyed. Because we're not doing anything really meaningful about it, because we don't want to commit. It's this half-assed strategy the administration has chosen. Bomb from afar, don't send any troops on the ground. Force all the terrorists into the major cities in Iraq and Syria. We may have partners in the Iraqi security forces to deal with that in Iraq. It might take some time. We have nobody on the ground in Syria. The forces that are there are really, you know, they were really anti-Assad forces that we agreed to give weapons to if they would go after the Islamic State fighters that are there. But at the end of the day, they don't really want to go after them. They want to go after Assad. And Assad knows that, which is why the Russians are bombing those proxy forces we've been building up, because they're a threat to the Assad regime. So to the extent that we ever build a force capable of actually taking them on, they will pose a significant enough threat to the Assad regime that the regime will attack those proxy forces, and they'll never have a chance to go after ISIS. So our strategy is fundamentally flawed from its base.
Alex, is there anything else that you can say tonight before we get off that makes me feel happy?
No.
Is there any? God damn. Well, dude, Wolf.
When it comes to our foreign policy, this is probably one of the darkest hours in our nation's history.
Tim, do you have any questions?
We've stood by and done nothing as the world burns around us, and now we're complaining about the after effects of our own peace corps actions.
You have anything over there, Tim?
Oh, man.
If you don't, it doesn't matter.
I
just like listening to him talk.
In the past few minutes, I've just been thinking about conspiracy theories, and so I'm totally out of the, you know what I mean?
Yeah. No, it's one of those things where it's such a foggy. You talk about fog of war. Well, if you're talking about the fog of the information war, there are so many places that your mind goes to try to explain and rationalize why something could happen, because it really just doesn't make sense. And Alex, you always like you always put a level spin on things, even if it's not the spin that we want to hear. But thank you so much for calling in. Would you be able to come into the studio sometime this week or next week or whatever?
Absolutely. Let's definitely set it up. And for the just for the answer to the conspiracy theory part for a second, we have spent literally the last 30 minutes in multiple shows discussing the utter incompetence and failure of our government to execute anything meaningful. Think of how much more competent they would have to be to actually organize something in order for some of these conspiracy theories to be true. Literally too stupid and too incompetent to even pull it off if they wanted to.
Well, you are a man that has seen many a sausage made, so I'm going to trust you on that one, man. But thank you so much for the call once again. And you know what? If it gets we always only scratch the surface. So I'd love to have you back on maybe sometime this week, even if it's just a phone call.
Absolutely, let's do it.
All right, man. Have a good night. Thank you so much for the time.
All right, guys. I'll talk to you all.
All right, later.
Bye.
Adios.
So that is Alex Plitzis, formerly of the department,
of the Beatles.
Formerly the defense of the Defense Department and the Beatles.
Yes, he's the eighth member.
Yeah, you know what? It's 7:47. Let's take a 30-second break just to cleanse the palate a little bit, and then we'll come back. We're going to talk with Tim. We're going to send this one on home, and at the 8 o'clock hour, I think I see Sam in the chat room. Our good boy, Sam Fukuyama Sutra. And his co-host, R. Trixie, you want to talk about a European point of view. Sam and R. Trixie are two very popular bloggers on Tumblr, actually. And they have a podcast called the Common Sense Podcast. They record it every Sunday. And here you go, Monday night at 8 p.m. We're going to start syndicating that rerun. So at 8 o'clock hour between tonight, between, quite frankly, and Gypsy's 9 o'clock broadcast, Hangover Takeover, we're going to have the Common Sense podcast on, so you guys are going to be able to listen to that. You won't be able to see them, but you're going to get some thoughts, opinions, and views from a couple of guys across the pond, both Germany and the UK, respectively. So we are the American front. They are the European front. I hope that we follow in the UK's footsteps. They've been showing a lot more propensity for liberty this year than we have. So we'll see. Other than that, you know what? Fuck the break. We can't do it. You know how Alex Jones says that all the time?
Oh, we're skipping the break. Could have another heart attack.
He has to tell you that they're coming for your income tax. It's their time to stop.
Coming for the income taxes, and we've got some fantastic nutraceuticals to sell you, too.
You know, that was I listened to Alex a long time, like a decade ago.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I consider myself a pretty skeptical person. I like listening to all the ideas across the board. But there was one episode where I'm watching where he's like, people, listen, they're coming with fear to scare you into giving up your income tax. Buy gold, buy all these products, buy vitamins, survival equipment. And I'm like, wait. They're trying to scare me? You're screaming at me right now about how they're going to come kill me. Like, you're trying to scare me too.
Call some god. I'm actually starting a Alex Jones folder in my browser over here of all the funniest things, the funniest rants he goes on, talking about goblins eating people. And
there's got to be an Alex Jones soundboard where you just push.
Oh, there is.
There's got to be.
There's been Alex Jones soundboard for a long. Black ops everywhere. It's been there for a long time, man. You know.
Here's what I wanted to say when I was thinking about conspiracies. I've been thinking this since we started when you brought it up. You have to have a lot of faith in humanity to believe in conspiracies. Because when I think about, you know, what goes on in the Middle East and, like, you're talking about shadow government, I just think that the average person, you know, we're all to blame as people for what we choose. It's like a very human thing. You know, it's kind of like we are to blame and we aren't because we're just human.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the reason we have all these problems, the reason Hillary Clinton wants to let in a bunch of refugees is because she's just trying to win popular support. I doubt she even cares about anybody.
She does not care about anybody.
I don't think politicians care about anybody. I think they're like, what opinion should I have to get the most support? That's the one I'll have.
Hedging their bets.
Yeah, right?
It's pretty much what it is. It's just like, what stance leaves me in a better position? Hillary Clinton would, you tell her what to say, she will say it. she will go out there and say it. I told you.
Well, she'll start coughing and then she'll be walked off stage.
Well, I saw. Have you ever seen the movie Dr. Strangelove?
No.
All right. Well, if you see it, very apropos for now. And Frank, I always stress that I would love to watch the movie with you because you'd love it. But there's a scene when, you know, a rogue American general essentially starts World War III, sends bombers after the Russians, and, you know, they're in the war room and they're trying to figure out how to stop it. And what happens is they start competing over what's going to happen after the bomb gets dropped, and they think that there's actually going to be a gap between what's going to happen after everyone comes up above ground. And is trying to circle my point around. Damn it, I lost my fucking point, Frank. Fuck.
Shit, I was right there with you.
Damn it.
For it.
I lost my fucking point.
You know, I'm just, if the apocalypse is going to happen, just happen already. It's the waiting I can't stand.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. This is what it was. They realized they couldn't pull the planes back, so they figured, well, if we can't bring our guys back, let's just bomb the Russians completely. And we've already done the calculations, and we figured that we would get 90% of their nuclear weapons, which would only leave like us like 10 million dead, but we would knock out like 90% of them. And the president was like, I'm not going to go down as, you know, being, you know, the biggest mass murderer of all time. But my point is that they have doomsday scenarios already planned out, like, well, we can still survive with 5 million people, we can, and it's all about the numbers. That's my point. It's all about the fucking numbers.
Yep,
that's my point.
Well, listen, they don't, that's why, that's the whole thing. You talk about them people, the political elite, saying and doing things to get elected. They don't give a shit about your education. Their kids will never sniff a classroom your kid goes to. This is all posturing. You know, it's ridiculous to think that somebody who wants to win the presidency, let's say a one day we actually have a senator from Montana who makes a run or something, and you really think that they care about kids getting good schooling in Miami, Florida, from Montana? Absolutely not. It's just something they say. The only thing that... If anybody cared about anybody, they would want to make sure that they had the ultimate amount of school choice and they were uninhibited by anything, any kind of top-down, one-size-fits-all, anything. Because the one thing that we've seen from one-size-fits-all government programs is it leads to death, just flat-out death. You know, the VA, that's in this country. You know, it's going to get worse and worse as Obamacare gets worse and worse, and they try to pump more funds into it, even though it's a failure. You look at what's going on with the NHS in the UK. I mean, all of those people screaming about how they're creating death panels, it certainly is. Not in a stated de jure way, but de facto, yes. We're going to decide, okay, it's almost like in, what was it, iRobot? Where Will Smith doesn't like the robot because it went to go save him instead of the kid because it determined that it had like a 27% chance better 27% better chance of saving Will Smith's life than the kid's, and it just went with the better probability instead of actually having that human instinct to go for the kid.
Right.
That's what government does when it manages, especially the sensitive aspects of people's lives. It leverages off who is worth the money and who should just wait. Right. You know, that's why people like Ezekiel Emanuel, who were the part of the architects of Obamacare, that were saying we need to get this into young people's hands because it's the preventative care that's going to make us healthier down the line. Then it gets implemented. He comes out and says, young people should actually not do their physical, get their physicals, because it's costing too much money. Well, duh. We knew this all along, that you're just saying all this shit so that young, able-bodied people are subsidizing the poor and the old and the sick. If you told that to young people just struggling to get out of college, they would have never voted for your ass.
I'm going to segue you here.
Go ahead.
Right. When talking about what's going to make us healthier and they want to do these programs, it makes me start thinking about the fat acceptance movement, right?
Mm.
You're familiar with all this. Now, here's what I wanted to say. You know, we need to encourage people to be active, to eat healthy, but most importantly, it's like, it's be active. You know, it's go for walks, go do things, and be out, because that's what's going to keep you healthy. And we have this idea that we'll be healthier when everyone has insurance. It's like, well, we're headed down a dangerous path of people chugging, you know, half a gallon of Coca-Cola with their cheeseburger, And a McDonald's cheeseburger has 90% of your daily sodium intake already. It's like, you know, we need to be healthy, right?
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's going to be much better preventative care. People making better choices, and it's a big challenge on how you make that happen, though.
Let me segue back into something that you had said before from that, too. So you have conspiracy theorists, especially the ones that are saying, hey, the food here, the air there, the drink there, this is done because of this, and, you know, all the conspiracies that tie together. But especially when it happens in this country, you look at how people are being manipulated through media. You look how people are becoming more and more sick and a lot more unhealthy through fast food and poor choices. But on the other hand, it's just a cage. It's almost like having the, you know how they had that donkey that's tied to the lawn chair, but it doesn't move because it believes that it's actually held in place, when it's just a choice of moving away and taking the lawn chair with you, dragging it along or shaking it off. I think it really just comes around to more informed choices, but who's giving us the information?
But, you know, so here's the thing, right? That's why I said you have to have a lot of faith in humanity to be a conspiracy theorist. Because people look at the media and say, you know what, the media is a corporate, there's corporatists are coming together to keep the people down. But then when having worked in media, and still do, and I mean you do too, you think about what do people, you know, if I could make a piece of content today that will get a ton of traffic and help build my channel and build my audience and make me money, what would it be? Well, the sad truth is it's not going to be an expose on a politician. It's going to be a cat doing a backflip. I don't think it's a conspiracy. I think you've got some guy in a suit saying, I don't know, I don't care, how do we make money?
And that's where you think it's apathy.
Yeah.
It's no, it's not apathy.
Stupidity.
No. It's here's the thing. How do everybody thinks they know what's right. Everybody thinks that their politics are the right politics, and that's the way the world works. People we grow up.
Everyone thinks their religion is the right one.
Exactly. Right. So then you end up with a guy. I'll talk from my own perspective. I'm doing news, and I'm trying to figure out the truth. And you know what? I've come to a point where I'm like, I don't care what people are going to yell at me for. I'm just going to report what I see, and I'm going to talk about what happened. And I'll let you know, that's my perspective. And then I get people on the left and the right attacking me. But you know what happens when I look at some of these left-wing and right-wing pundits, these super feminists, these super alt-right guys? They have 10 times as many followers as I do. Okay, maybe not 10, but like, you know, 3 or 4 times as many followers. There's super famous feminists who will disregard truth in favor of their audience.
Anita Sarkeesian.
But they end up with, you know, 300,000 followers, you know, and even Milo Yiannopoulos, you know, alt-right troll, like he gets his 330,000 Twitter followers before they nixed him.
I think it almost goes back to the food scenario. I think the alt-right and the extreme left, I mean, that is McDonald's. That is sugar. It tastes good. It feels good.
And everyone keeps buying it.
Everyone keeps buying it. You're the health food.
So here's what happens. The people who are running these businesses, and, you know, so the CEO walks in, and the CEO says, I don't follow politics. You know, I've been wrapped up in finance and, like, setting up our office in Detroit. What's the latest? Well, I don't know. What should we do? Let's just do whichever one's going to get the most appeal and make the most money. And so then what ends up happening is the media just goes in a direction they think people want. And then it builds up these extremes, and it leads us to be ridiculously left or ridiculously right, eating crazy sugars and fats, drinking Coke nonstop, chugging it, and then being like, you know what, being fat's okay.
Yeah. You know what Jack LaLanne said, everybody? I always say it. If it tastes good, spit it out. It's probably not good for you. Hey, Tim, thank you so much for joining us tonight, man. And your unbiased approach to all of the issues that you cover is one of the reasons why we have kept tabs on your work for years now. You know, we were down there in Zuccotti Park covering Occupy Wall Street, not in the sense that you were, that you actually traveled with it. I think your traveling is the most impressive part of your work. Really, really, really appreciate you coming in here. And we'll have more updates on future stuff that we're going to be doing with Tim soon, hopefully. And other than that, I just wanted to thank a few people before we get off here tonight, and then we're going to leave you in the loving arms of the audio from the Common Sense podcast straight from the UK. Number one, if you like the Quite Frankly podcast, please go out and give it a rating and a review on iTunes. That little bit really does a lot for visibility on those charts. check it out, please. So go on there and make me happy. Aside from that, you can check us out on Patreon. That's patreon.com/quitefrankly. We've got fantastic things up there that I am proud of that I would not put up there. I didn't want to do Patreon for a while, but finally I thought of some really free market things that I think is a really good trade-off for your monetary support of the show. $1, $5, $10, or the coveted limited 1776 Club. That's when I write you your monthly letter, handwritten letter, like we are Jefferson and Adams just going back and forth with each other. That's amazing right there. And also, I want to thank my bosses, Michael Wells, Nikki Solis, Andrew Dame, Laura Veris, Matt Smith, Sean Collins, Christian Peppers of the Amatory Murder, Maxian Caparato, Jenny Lee, Jackie Milam, and Mad Mints. You guys are my bosses. Thank you so much for the support. Never forget it. And also, thank you guys for hanging out in ZenLive.tv. If anybody has any kind of ideas for content for ZenLive, let us know. You can email me at frank@zenlive.tv or gypsy@zenlive.tv. Gypsy's our program director. And that's it. Anything. You have a man on the street sketch you want to start, let us know. You want to write for the blog? We don't have anybody writing for our blog, so that'd be
awesome.
I was going to turn it into a diary of mine because we just need something up there. All right, guys. Have a great night. Talk to you soon. 8 o'clock to 9 o'clock, Common Sense Post podcast. And then at 9 o'clock, Hangover Takeover with your very own Standby Gypsy.
Oh, yeah. And Juju the Model.
And Juju the Model. All right, guys. See you very soon. And Tim, what are some... promote some of your URLs so people can check out your work.
Oh, it's easy. Just TimCast, right? So Twitter, Instagram, TimCast, TimCast. And then my YouTube channel, youtube.com/TimCast. Patreon, I'm on Patreon. So, Periscope too, right? So if you're going to catch my breaking news, you know, follow me on Twitter is probably the easiest and most important way to do it. And my live coverage will be on Periscope.
That's it. Yeah. Guys, seriously do it. This is many, many years of good work already behind them, awards and acknowledgments and lots of impressive stuff. So if you are always looking for good people to follow on Twitter or anywhere, definitely follow Tim @TimCast. Talk to you guys soon. See you tomorrow, 7 o'clock.